Well, good afternoon and welcome to the second lecture in Reporting Continuity and Change. As you can see, it's entitled The Heyday of Political Satire? Print cultures, publishers, hacks and readers. Most of you should hopefully have received the free gift that I've carefully prepared for you today, taken from the current edition of Private Eye, a little work of Theresa May. If you haven't actually got one of these, then I've left a few at the front desk that you can pick up at the end of the session. I think I've started to circulate most of the group with them from that point of view. Which maybe shows one of the indications of where a modern-day equivalent exists that relates to the work that, in particular, Hone and Cruikshank were involved with. And what are we going to be talking about today? Well, primarily, I want to start talking about the question of what is satire? Always good practice whenever you're doing any academic work, start off by defining your terms. What do we actually mean by the process of satire in general? Well, that's a rough and ready definition of what we refer to when we talk about satire. Text or performance that uses irony, derision, or wit to expose or attack human vice, foolishness, or stupidity. So a fairly wide-ranging definition that you've got there. And one satirist that I know we spoke about yesterday with the Tudor Group is very much Jonathan Swift, writing in the Georgian era, again in the 18th century, a little bit after the Peterloo Massacre, but writing very much about his own view and take on society at the time. He was writing from the perspective of an Irish writer, and if you ever get a chance to read the unexpurgated version and the uncensored version of Gulliver's Travels, do take it, because it certainly sort of goes into a whole range of aspects within the satirical field. And South Park, The Onion, the areas of Family Guy, Private Eye, all use satire to a greater or lesser extent to enable them to comment on issues relating to society. Does this mean that the creators of South Park are journalists? Well, that's to be discussed in seminars and so on. Because we looked last week at the way in which the development of the press in Britain brought about the making and remaking of public opinion. It actually started setting the scene by making national opinion. Certainly during the later part of the 18th century, the early 19th centuries, because of the increasing frequency at which print was being used, obviously ideas were being circulated and generally changed around and adjusted within that whole field. And satire was also used in print to convey political views to an increasing and quite sophisticated readership. So we looked last week at some of the kind of changes aspects that were coming through. This is a technique that really begins to emerge during this particular time period between 1780 and 1830. There's a 50-year area where satire really actually comes to the fore as a technique and a strategy that's being used. And as ever, there are various leading lights in terms of how this develops from the historical text that comes within that whole field. Two of those leading lights are William Hone, who lived from 1780 to 1842, who wrote the words, and the artist George Cruikshank, C-R-U-I-K-S-H-A-N-K, who lived from 1792 to 1878. Hone and Cruikshank arguably could be seen as the leading lights in the satirists of the day. A couple of key things that we mentioned there. They did comment on the Peterloo Massacre. I'll show you the examples of the political house that Jack built, which was published at the same time as the Peterloo Massacre. And they also had some fairly strong comments to actually write about the Queen's matrimonial ladder, as they said. Satire has been used at critical moments throughout history in a variety of ways. The Peterloo Massacre of 1819 was a fairly critical and crucial moment. As we said last week, the Manchester Yeomanry were brought on board to effectively sort out apolitical gathering that was being headed by Henry Hunt. It was the equivalent to the Kent State Massacre at the height of the Vietnam War in America, or arguably the Tiananmen Square Massacre in China towards the end of the 20th century. In other words, you had the state effectively using their power to enforce an authoritarian approach and deal very harshly with anybody who disagreed with them. The other sort of aspect that comes across as a target for the satirists was the royal family. And in particular, in the 19th century, there was the question of the royal marriage between a prince who effectively was in love with architecture and a variety of other elements as well, but also had a mistress who had, and a wife who also had several lovers. It was a disaster. And one of the challenges that you also get there is the way in which readership is really actually moving substantially for all newspapers. If you look at the figures that we've put there, between 1764 and 1790, copies of newspapers distributed by the post office, this is only distributed because, remember, each one of these copies was probably read by a minimum of 10 people, or read out to various 10 people, went from 1 million to just under 5 million. So a big move in terms of the sort of lines that we actually get there, just in terms of what's out there using the medium of print. So an idea that goes out and is released to the public via print, newsletters, news leaflets, etc., is going to have a massive impact. There's our first example of a Hone and Cruikshank wood engraving with an image of George, Prince of Wales, elder son of George III and his wife, Princess Caroline. One of the things that is challenging for scholars of this particular period is because these were printed on newsprint, because they were effectively not deemed as having a huge cultural value, we actually lost a substantial amount of the work that they've produced. So what we've got, in a sense, this early part of the 21st century, is the equivalent of the greatest hits of Hone and Cruikshank. The house, the political house that Jack built, is one of them. Another one is this particular heavy critique on the royal family. A family that was seen at the time as being German, Hanoverian, out of touch with society, out of touch with reality, and effectively almost sort of at odds with what it meant to be British at the time. Again, you have that whole notion of give us the strength unto women, and a whole range of sort of aspects that's coming through within that. Private Eye, as I say, the contemporary sort of equivalent, that's one example there. And the visual image is also critical when it comes to satire. The message that comes across here is quite simple. No difference between David Cameron and Tony Blair, other than the fact that their faces have changed. Who knows what they're going to do, obviously, with Theresa May. Maybe the sheet that I've actually just handed out to your good self gives you another insight in terms of that. So in other words, it's using very basic standard lines to approach and get the gag. You know, we talk in comedy about the gag reflex and how you actually sort of go for that instant or the punchline. And using that sort of violent metaphor, it sort of opens up the whole notion of, oh, fine, that's the point that's being made. What is the point that's being made within the Peterloo Massacre? Well, again, it's that something is wrong here. And as we looked at last time, areas such as going to the courts to print the truth, going to deal with newspapers who were overly taxed, might not have worked because there were heavy taxations being used, and there were also issues relating to, obviously, the legal system, which did change and adjusted, as we've seen and talked about. But ultimately, you have this image of something where it's embarrassing. You have murder amongst the whole sort of sequence, and you also get to the stage whereby the growing numbers of people who could read about this is also impacting on society and so on. E.P. Thompson, the historian E.P. Thompson, suggested that something like 2 out of every 3 working men were able to read in some form or other by the beginning of the 19th century. although rather fewer were actually able to write. So more could actually read than actually write, but a significant number of those people who could actually read would form part of a growing newspaper readership. The writer Michael Harris talks about the number of London-based newspapers distributed through the post office rising substantially in the second half of the 18th century. And the distribution networks that were being used to spread newspapers and cheap press, tuppenny halfpence press, etc., would involve street hawkers, so the equivalent of the Big Issue at this particular time, etc., the sales are the Big Issue, and a large growing volume of distributors who would hand out the newspapers, sell the papers and the print, etc. So the key thing to bear in mind at this time is that print culture is at the heart. It is not only the social networking of the time, it's the combination of YouTube, Pinterest, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, all in one. Okay? It is the only sort of major way in which news is being disseminated frequently, the power of the print. And so something like the political house that Jack built, again, in its own way, it carries with it that whole notion of something that is meant to last, that is actually built on strange foundations. It's seen very much as the political house that Jack builds, a straw thrown up to show which way the wind blows. That's the subtext. So the message is clearly that what is happening here in terms of the writing of Hone and Cruikshank is that the pen is mightier than the sword. The pen weighing much more, the sword there, the pen and the sword is put into place there and produced by and for William Hone, Ludgate Hill. It's a message that's getting out that even if you had no indication of what was happening in Peterloo, certainly the appreciation of what was going on starts opening up a whole range of discussions. Talked about Hone doing the words and Cruikshank doing the illustrations. Those are some of the words. I'll just sort of share them with you from that point of view, as you can see on the screen. These are the people all tattered and torn who cursed the day wherein they were born. On account of taxation too great to be borne. This to be seen again in parallel to the print we saw earlier of the Peterloo Massacre. Pray for relief from night to morn who in vain petition in every form, who peaceably meeting to ask for reform, were sabred by yeoman cavalry, who were thanked by the man all shaven and shorn, all covered with orders and all forlorn. The dandy of 60, the king, who bows with a grace and has taste in wigs, collars, cuirasses and lace, who to tricksters and fools leaves the state and its treasure, and when Britain's in tears, sails about at his pleasure. Now the kind of rhyming couplets that are actually used in this language echo basic nursery rhymes. They echo childhood, they're parodying the sort of standard line that you actually get in the popular songs, the popular culture of the time from that perspective. But the message is clear as clear can be that this is wrong. This is a way of protesting. This is a way of actually using satire to actually say fundamentally there are huge issues that you actually have here. There are problems that sort of, you know, connect and really need to be addressed. And if you are members of the working class, you're clubbing together to buy copies, you're getting together in the inns, the taverns, the social areas of the time. You know, clearly, if we look at one interesting statistic, in 1833, John Doherty's coffee shop in Manchester subscribes to no fewer than 96 different weekly newspapers. Yeah, it's a substantial number of areas that are coming through within that whole area. And again, the line that a single copy of a London daily newspaper could have been seen by between 10 and 40 readers. So inevitably, that increasing readership, that increasing influence of the press, increased the government's desire to regulate publication. If you were thinking last week about, it's all very well talking about how the government regulated this, but why did they do this? What was their motivation? Well, they could see it was very popular. Popularity can be good, but it can be very worrying. Mass uprisings, as we've seen, can be the result if you get a popular movement that captures the imagination. regulating publication is always considered very important during times of national crisis. Years when Britain was at war, years when Britain's subject to a variety of international threats. And as we saw last week, the chief methods that the government used to actually control the press were through the imposition of taxes levied on each copy of a newspaper, every advert and on the paper itself, as well as other issues put together such as subsidies, the supply of exclusive information, official adverts, and indeed payments to individual journalists or bribing. As we also saw, some of those methods backfired. If it became known that a journal was in receipt of government subsidies, its authority was immediately undermined. But such government strategies for controlling the press were really only effective when papers had relatively low circulations. And yet at times of national crisis, that's precisely when usually you find newspaper sales and other media forms tend to increase, and increase substantially. So how does that then relate to the notion of the satirists and the connections within that? Well, rather than go to jail, rather than to effectively suffer from excessive taxation and so on, they could actually take this line of saying it's a parody, it's not meant to be taken seriously. They could actually comment, as we saw there, on issues relating to the Queen's matrimonial ladder. Why do they call that a sort of particular issue? Well, as we said, the Queen, after the death of George III, oh my word, there's a bit of flatulence there, but no, it's okay, it's just a phone that's coming through. I might edit that out of the podcast, but still. In terms of the Queen's matrimonial ladder, the wife of the incoming Prince Regent, because George III effectively is coming to the end of his particular time, had been notorious throughout Europe. She'd lived away, effectively, whilst her husband had been carrying on with all sorts of activities and so on. And as you can see there, some of the kind of classic lines that we accept today as standard practice in journalism. Look at the heading there, by the author of the political house that Jack built. It's the classic Amazon. If you like this, you like that. A national toy with 14 step scenes and illustrations in verse with 18 other cuts. A cut, in this instance, is actually used to describe the illustration. It's put together there. That's how we actually see those things originally put in print and carved down at that particular base. And, just again looking through the whole verse of the question, is not merely whether the Queen shall have her rights, but whether the rights of any individual in the kingdom shall be free from violation. Now you're talking about fairly incendiary stuff though, certainly more incendiary than perhaps you'd see if you were criticising the monarchy today. But again, it's at the heart of that whole notion of saying maybe having a monarchy is at the heart of our problem. We'd already seen that France had disposed of its monarchy in a different sort of way. So you have that tension between the state, between the government, between the individual peoples, and between the population who are reporting on that package. I won't bother going too much through this, I'll break this down in a few moments. But what you actually got and received if you purchased the Queen's matrimonial ladder as a news pamphlet and part of the pamphleteers was a free little ladder, free sheet of paper to actually sort of illustrate that. So it also begins to lead to that whole notion of the free gifts and the suggestion that it could be you. I use that symbol there because, again, in the early days of the National Lottery, when you were just in your cribs, etc., you had that notion of it could be you, it could be me, it could be all sorts of things from that perspective. And you can go through that whole process of emigration, exculpation, demarcation, constatation, accusation, publication. You know, a whole range of key things there. It's a cartoon strip. Okay, it's an expanded cartoon strip which was developed and worked on, which as we see today in terms of Private Eye still has echoes and resonances in the 21st century. And I'm going to go on to talk a little bit about Punch magazine as well and how that actually existed up until actually the early start of the 21st century. This is one of the lines that was used in the matrimonial ladder, which again is very visceral. It's very, I suppose you would say, it's the equivalent to an Eminem or a P. Daddy or a rapster, gangster, element that comes through in the spaces, but it is actually developing that whole thing. The queerest of all the queerest sites I've set sight on is that, what do you call thing here, the Folly Capitals at Brighton. The outside, huge teapots all drilled round with holes, relieved by extinguishers sticking on poles. The inside, all tea things and dragons and bells. The showrooms all show, the sleeping rooms cells. But the grand curiosity is not to be seen, the owner himself, an old fat mandarin. He was an absentee monarch. You know, he wasn't seen. He was, in a sense, ripe to be made fun of. When he was seen, as we saw at the start there, he was basically somebody who certainly did not look in the peak of his prime. A patron of painters who copy designs, so they're not even producing original material here, that grocers and tea dealers hang up for signs. It's very patronising, but again, it's addressing that whole notion. Hence, tea board taste artists gain rewards and distinction. Hence, his title of teapot shall last to extinction. I saw his great chair into which he falls, soss, and sits in his china shop like a large joss. Again, what's the response to this? If you said, you can't do this, George and William, you should be executed for this. It's all right. It's only meant to be taken as a parody. It's not meant to be taken seriously. And again, that's one of these sort of areas that the equivalent of almost saying, well, it's only a joke. It only sort of adjusts that. There were issues with respect to Punch magazine that were seen as being less problematic. Punch magazine was established by Henry Mayhew. It was established in 1841 and actually ran until 2002. It was a very British institution. Mayhew had specifically said he didn't want to necessarily go for the jugular. He didn't want to really criticise society. He wanted to make a sort of light-hearted commentary on society and so on. And it generally was regarded as having a witty and irreverent take on the world. Some of the writers who actually featured in Punch included William Thackeray, P.J. Woodhouse, P.J. O'Rourke. So again, they built up a range of writers and worked through that whole basis. Political cartoons featured in Punch swayed governments, and social cartoons captured life in the 19th and 20th centuries. There were a number of cartoonists who appeared in Punch, such as E.H. Shepherd, Tennille, Pont. They all actually worked with the process, and they developed a long-lasting style. Punch actually continues to work, whereas the short, sharp shock of Honan Cruikshank tended to ease away from that particular aspect. So let's return to this one. What are the key things to actually take away from this initial sort of piece that we've got here? Well, literacy was increasing. The more literate a society, the more you effectively have more people who can read, the better it is for obviously them to have something to read. There is a criticism that suggests that what was being produced was nothing more than simple scandal sheets. It's all very well if you're producing the Queen's Matrimonial Ladder, but really, is that in good taste? If we're talking about taste and decency and issues related to that, is it appropriate to be commenting on the King of England in such a way? Or is it simply fair comment? Would we actually, as a population, still, if we were there at the time and even now, would we still actually treat with the same reverence the objects of the humour? If we start objectifying individuals, doesn't that also lead to challenges? Because how can you then take seriously people who are effectively elected or are in the ruling positions? So you can see there are kind of issues on both sides in terms of how effective the aspect can be. Also, something else that emerges is the notion of improving literature as an improving aspect, as opposed to something which people will simply snigger at. If it's simply the equivalent to lavatorial humour, does that really resonate with society as a whole? Does it actually improve society? Does it effect change? Or is it just a cheap laugh? When we start talking about the way in which literacy spreads, there is a big difference between when you're actually reading things, and if you actually read St. Teresa's Independent State Grammar School for Girls and Boys, formerly the Cameron Free School, formerly the Coalition Academy, headmistress Mrs. T. May, M.A. Oxon, you might well take that and say, oh, fine, okay, we get that, we understand that. But if that's your only introduction to the Prime Minister and the views with respect to that whole thing, or indeed Boris Johnson, does it leave you with a positive image? Does it leave you with a caricature? Does it educate? Does it develop? Again, there are issues relating to how effective it actually is. Is it effective as a shorthand? Undoubtedly. Is it effective as a way of actually addressing those key things? Certainly. But what is the after effect and so on? Regulation, as we've seen, was tried and effectively failed. And so we had a situation where the government, with respect to regulation, even after taxes and after they'd taken stamp duty, then reduced stamp duty and resisted it by 75%, we still had a situation where control is there. And the history, as we'll see as we head through the module, of regulating the media is very much of that aspect where you start considering how do you regulate the populations and what they're actually receiving to ensure that what they're receiving is comprised of appropriate messages and so on. And in this particular generation, the first flowerings, if you like, of real alternative press writing, almost underground writing that we would see again echoed in the middle decades of the 20th century, what Hone and Cruikshank were doing, was it simply for altruistic reasons? Were they self-sacrificing? No, they were actually making money. Part and parcel of even Private Eye is it actually is set up to make money and work on that basis. Even, as I say, the classic recent cover, Private Eye, from the 23rd of June, England backs Brexit, and we have the English football team with "We'll be out of Europe in no time," as I said to an earlier group, curiously prescient as well from that point of view. How radical is it? Images have always been used historically to kind of show up caricatures, etc. Even if you actually look in the days of the ancient Babylonians and the Egyptians and so on, they still had their equivalent of cartoons and elements within that. But this juxtaposition of satire and print culture that Hone and Cruikshank specifically actually formulated, cultivated and worked through is really at the heart of the whole notion of how we see satire today. So to return to that original title and the question mark that I deliberately put in terms of that opening line, the heyday of political satire, yes, phenomenally popular at its time in that 30-year period or so, primarily between the late sort of 1800s and the beginning of the 19th century, it still exists, it still has a cult following. But again, the vast majority, certainly from my initial two seminar groups, vast majority of people in this room don't read Private Eye. May not even be aware that Private Eye actually exists as a satirical, current, fortnightly produced newspaper, which has had its own challenges and lines within that whole field. So maybe, as I say, we have moved away from the notion where it was the must-discussed equivalent of the day. Publishers are in the business of making money. Hacks is a common way of actually referring to writers and so on. And readers are the folk that ultimately we actually look to influence as practical journalists. We just return briefly to something which again we'll have to relate to another particular time here. Just back up slightly there. Oops. Trial by Laughter. It's no longer available from that point of view. But as you saw there in terms of the BBC review, William Hone, the forgotten hero of free speech in Britain. Bookseller, publisher, and satirist. One thing I didn't actually share with you. His trial in 1817 for impious blasphemy was about a parody he'd done about the Lord's Prayer. He'd taken the words of the Our Father and rewrote it to effectively refer to members of Parliament as deliverers from rotten boroughs and a whole variety of other things. And that was the initial trigger that led him to stand trial initially for as we said, blasphemy. And blasphemy as a particular challenge is something which over the years has moved from capital punishment, i.e. an offence of that can merit death, through to mild censure. You could argue that one of the challenges with respect to Charlie Hebdo was it was blasphemy that the alternate viewpoint were sort of claiming that was the issue. It was a blasphemous offence. And if you blaspheme, then you should be immediately executed and taken on board for all sorts of other areas. The trial itself, and if you recall last week we talked about the jury, once it was established that it was simply a parody and that he hadn't actually meant to cause offence and it was not meant to be taken seriously, that was the equivalent in 1817 to in the public interest a few years later. It was a legal area that effectively enabled that whole element to be developed and worked through. And that particular sort of aspect that we see there of the satirist and so on is very much that whole essence of where we are now. Cruikshank's line that he actually says there, which I think is worth commenting on from that point of view, "I live on gin and water, my mouth lets the gin in and my boots the water." Again, you're addressing the sort of line. These were not working class as such. They weren't necessarily ruling class, but they were in that growing sense of the balance that's working through on that basis. And again, I'll allow you to sort of peruse from that sort of side of things from that point of view, seditious libel, blasphemy, and so on. And yet, we don't really remember them today. Okay, where are we going? Something again to consider and talk about from that perspective. Do make sure that you get your free gifts today. I say there are a few others that we've actually got here, which is the one Charlie's Private Eye. Take a chance to actually have a look at some of the editions of Private Eye that do exist within the library and various other sort of factors. Where we move on to from this is even more exciting, because we'll be talking about the existence of fairies, the existence of broadsides, and indeed the sort of other areas that we use to capture that audience, to work and develop within that whole audience, and within print culture, how both radical writing and change can be affected, tied in, for a variety of reasons. Thanks for your time, and I will see again some of you in seminar.